Hello and welcome to Integrated Rhythm, two swing dancing besties exploring race in jazz music and jazz dance and the jazz swing dance scene. That is Chisoma Soleimani and myself, Bobby White. And this week we have a special guest. It is Taryn Newborn. Taryn Newborn started off in ballroom dance before finding swing and Lindy Hop and has combined her love of swing dance with her musical background and now is an amazing swing singer and band leader. She considers the swing scene as part of her family, and the two are so intertwined that both of her sons are Frankie Manning ambassadors. Today we talk about what a swing scene family means, swing music, and hopes for how we can emerge from the pandemic. Now, full disclosure, this interview was recorded a little bit ago, and so we still think it is a fantastic conversation. However, if you go and ask Taryn about some of the things that she said in this interview, she might say, I might need to go back and listen to that. Just so you know. Anyway, let's hear it for Taryn Newborn, who's amazing.
Integrated Rhythm with Chisoma and Bobby.
Woohoo!
Hey!
Hey.
Taryn Newborn.
It's me.
Yes. The amazing and the fantastic Taryn.
Aw, thank you.
I love seeing your face. I do. And I miss it, actually, like a lot.
I miss you guys so much that I try not to think about it sometimes.
Yeah.
It's too overwhelming.
Yeah.
Oh man. That makes it, yeah, I haven't really thought about that a lot. How much of managing our mental health these days is like putting on certain blinders and just like charging ahead. There was a time where I just like put my head down and just like, I just need to not think about anything for a while. Mm-hmm. Just to like be happy.
Yeah.
It's the shift. Yeah, I still, first of all, this time feels like it's gone by so quickly, but it also feels like it's crawled by. So, yeah. And if we couldn't get together for another 5 years, I would never get used to not seeing all of my favorite people, several times a year.
Yeah. I mean, with July just having passed by, I was thinking about Beantown. And so each July, I just kind of like, ugh.
Yeah. The Facebook notifications are a little rough to take sometimes.
Yeah.
They're like, this time in 2019, here are all these incredible memories you were having.
Yeah. It's too much. And, you know, most of the Facebook memories that I have are, you know, of course, of my favorite people and then also of my boys. You know, and so I get to see a little timeline of, you know, them maturing and, you know, because also during the pandemic, I became an empty nester. So compound that with, you know, just life in general. And then my son does, you know, I'm still responsible for him in a way, but, you know, I'm no longer a day-to-day mom. So a little grief there.
Like a lot. So, because of time, when did your youngest go to college?
Well, he's actually taking some gap time.
I don't think I've ever met someone who regretted taking a gap year or two.
No, and I don't blame him. He's an artist. He's a multifaceted artist. And, you know, he's a vocal.
Where did he get that from?
Growing up watching his parents, you know, sing and dance and all of that. He's a visual artist. Yeah. And he's far surpassing anything that I could do with, he's composing and producing and just finding all on his own. He's a multi-instrumentalist, self-taught.
That's so cool. I would love if we have children, I would love for them to grow up in a very musical household, get instruments and playing and all that kind of stuff. I grew up in a music loving household. Mm-hmm. But no one could play instruments or that kind of stuff. So I was one of the first in my family to actually learn to play instruments. Wow. And you know, when I hear stories about like your sons who got to grow up in that household and just like instruments being thrown at them and the time to learn them and pushing them.
We didn't push them.
Pushing them, you know, just letting them organically find that, you know.
Yeah, you kind of see they were just around us. Like for instance, when they learned Lindy Hop, you know, we they didn't really start to develop a passion for it. I mean, they don't always come to dances that I went to, and or when I would sing, they'd come and help with sound equipment and stuff like that. And if they danced if they wanted to, or they hung out and played, you know, with their friends. But it wasn't until Beantown that they actually, okay, now I feel like a Lindy Hopper and I want to kind of do this on my own. Same with the instruments. You know, I think we put Joshua in piano lessons because he kind of had an interest, but he wouldn't practice and he would frustrate the teacher. So we stopped. We stopped piano lessons and he really just wanted to play. Of course, you know, by then YouTube was around. So he had, so he would start to compose his own stuff. And because we were listening to jazz and stuff like that, he found things on the piano and he played for our church. My parents were the pastors. My dad actually played bass in our worship band. And so one day my mom asked him to play his instrumental piece, and his teacher who would come to visit our church, you know, she's sitting in on flute. I mean, we're such a bohemian church, but
that is awesome.
Yeah. And so his teacher, he was a little bit older. So he started taking lessons when he was 10 for about 6 months, then flash forward to he's about 14 or 15. And his teacher is sitting in with us in the band. And my mom says, Joshua, play your original instrumental. So he starts to play and his teacher, she's listening and she looks, and then he plays the second chord. And she goes, you know, and she was like, what in the world is going on? So by that time she'd had a baby and she offered to barter him babysitting for piano lessons. And she wanted him to teach her the chords that he was learning or that he had, you know, composed for himself. So again, all in all, it was all of the things that they saw us do. We didn't want to push them into, we just kind of wanted to see where it went.
It seems like you have this gift for cultivating artists because you gave your kids the space to be the artists that they wanted to be versus like pushing them into a specific route to be like copies of somebody else, you know?
I mean, as their mom, I have ideas about where I would love for them, things that I would love for them to do. And especially because I'm, you know, a teacher, you know, I'm a drama teacher, I'm a voice teacher, and I can see things that I think that they would be good at. But then there's the kid resistance to the part like mom, and I'm just mom, you know, and so I'm like, well, you know, okay, whatever you want to do, but I really think you should.
I think it's kind of funny that I ended up in a field where I'm doing some research when my mom eventually became a researcher, and that's what she's been doing. She did for the last 20 years. And I remember her trying to explain to me what she did. And every time I would like black out after like 30 seconds, I would just be like, she'd say words. And I just, so people would ask me, what did your mom do? I'm like, she worked out of college. But somehow it like sunk in. And at some point, because of somebody else, I was like, oh my gosh, research is amazing. And my mom's sitting here like, I've been saying that for 15 years.
No, your kids never, they would rather listen to someone else, and it clicks. But your mother sowed the seeds and someone else cultivated, you know, just watered it. And you think it's your idea, and it's not.
It's not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, you know, to that point, my former husband, their dad, is an electrical and mechanical engineer, you know, so we couldn't be more polar opposites. Although, you know, I don't know if you had a chance to meet him, but Bobby did. He was also a swing dancer and he sang and stuff like that. And we had a band. And so Joshua decided to go in the Navy. They put him in for electrical engineering, you know. And, yeah. So all of his aptitude tests and things like that.
How all these things come together. But speaking of like origin stories, we'd love to hear a little bit about you and like what drew you into this jazz music swing dancing space.
Okay. I was born in Memphis, raised mostly in Atlanta, grew up in Atlanta, spent most of my life in Atlanta. I have a couple of famous jazz blues artist family. If you want to Google Phineas Newborn, who was called Finest Newborn and is a piano player. If you ask any jazz musician who Phineas or Finest Newborn is, they'll be like, oh my gosh, you know. And Calvin Newborn, his brother, was a blues guitarist. And I didn't really know them growing up. I knew their mom, and I'd met them a couple of times when I was little. And so that was just kind of in me a little bit. Flash forward to my sister going off to college. And when she went to college, she discovered Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday and Sarah Vaughan and all those people. And she brings them back. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And at that same time, I was doing musical theater, and there was one particular show. With the Sharks and the Jets.
Oh, West Side Story?
West Side Story, thank you. Yeah. So the Mambo scene, I played Anita. And so the Mambo scene, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm totally digging this ballroom dancing thing. Flash forward a little bit more, I decided to, around my college years, because I got married like near my sophomore year of college. And so I decided I wanted to learn to train to teach ballroom dancing. And, you know, loved that whole scene. I trained when just after Jonas was born, I trained for my first ballroom competition. And then, you know, that can be really, really expensive. And so I was like, well, let me try this salsa thing a little bit, because it felt like the ballroom dances were the watered down versions of all of the original things. So I started to get an interest there. Mm-hmm. And so while I'm in, you know, hanging out at a salsa club, I meet two Lindy Hoppers in the bathroom, and they tell me to, you know, they were talking, I heard what they were saying. It's like, oh my gosh, where do you do that? And they said, well, we go to Georgia Tech once a month, and here's this dance. And I think it took me a few months to finally go. And lo and behold, the first person to ask me to dance was Bobby White. Yes, he was teaching with Kate. And so I took the beginner lesson, but you know, ballroom swing is if you do triple count East Coast swing in ballroom, you're essentially learning the Lindy Hop rhythm. And so I could follow a little bit and things like that. But after once the dance started and the lesson was over, Bobby was the first person to ask me to dance. And everyone was, I could not believe how nice everyone was. That's when I met Stacy and Peter. Yeah, Stacy and Peter worked with me on stuff just out of nowhere. You know, we were at that one room where Mike Geyer in King Size would play. And it was it was just a small group of people. And they just sat with me and taught me things, you know. And I hadn't learned swing out yet. And that took maybe another year before I learned swing out. And I learned swing out just before the ATLX in 2008. So, and then from then on, I was like, well, what else am I going to do with my life? So that's how I got into the swing dancing world. Yeah.
And then what took you into jazz music?
Oh, well.
Or the singing?
So what happened in jazz music? Again, singing in church all the time, doing musical theater. I got a chance to audition for this band called The Usual Suspects. And all of the songs that I ever wanted to sing, that I learned from my sister back in high school, I didn't know where, you know, it's like, where are people singing these things? I don't know, but I would love a chance to. So I got to audition for this one band. Didn't know, you know, anyone. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's a big book of all the songs I ever wanted to perform. And so they played for Georgia Tech dance. And by then all of my friends had come. It was like 700 people that showed up to Georgia Tech. And it was Nima and Michelle who came up to me and said, hey, why don't you start your own swing band? And I'm like, huh. So I put a few people, and by then, you know, being in the ballroom, you know, I was like, where can I do more of this? Excuse me, being in the big band, met a lot of jazz musicians, and I asked them, you know, where can I do more of this? They said, well, go hang out at jam sessions. So jam sessions are nothing but like auditions for you and networking events for you to go and meet people. You like their sound, you say, hey, I'm doing this event, you want to come play? And so I put together a few things for the people that I knew, and put together my first set for the holiday party in 2010. And we didn't even know what the band was called at that time. You know, somebody, I think Nima asked, you know, at one of the hot jams, he said, what's your band's name? I said, I don't know. We'll find out Wednesday when we practice. And so for a while we were the Wednesday night quartet, Taryn and the Wednesday night quartet. and it just kind of, you know, kind of molded from there.
Did y'all settle on a different name eventually?
So I had a contest because I didn't want to keep it the Wednesday Night Band. And I asked for different ideas for names. And then my cousin, Calvin, you know, he was at that time, he was in his 80s, the guitarist that I told you about, he lives in Florida. And he would always say, he always call himself Mr. Real. And, you know, whatever he was doing, he said, well, Mr. And he posts, Mr. Real's deal is I'm going to blah, 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 such and such, you know. And I was like, how can I keep it in the family? So I named the band Taryn Newborn and the Real Deal.
Fantastic name.
Thanks.
Let's see. What are some of your favorite experiences as a singer in the swing scene?
Gosh, how much time do we have? Some of my favorite experiences, I'd have to say, you know, first of all, getting to develop a band, develop a sound. And then when I started to travel, and what led to my travel was, you know, being on staff at different events, which eventually led to going to Beantown. And my husband at the time had told Tony and Orly, you know, my wife sings, you know, and I don't know what he was going to do with that information. I think it was before I was asked to help stage manage, because I have a theater background, stage manage the Beantown Bounce show, which is all the professionals and all of those people. And so he says, you know, my wife sings, and, you know, and I was like, yeah, it'd be fun to do something maybe next year. And Tony said, the show's the next day. Tony said, oh no, you're going to be in the show tomorrow. So I was like, okay. And, you know, as a musician, you know, I'm kind of trained for this. If somebody wants me to sing, I at least have 3 or 4 songs in my head that are appropriate. It's just, you know, that's what I teach my students. Think of something in case something just hits on the spot. But I didn't have anybody to accompany me, so I asked Jonathan Stout. And so I sang Honeysuckle Rose for Beantown Bounce with Jonathan Stout.
I think I was in that room.
Yes. Yeah. and then that, not only that, and at that same Beantown, gosh, Gordon Webster asked me to sit in with the band. And so that was just like the highlight of my life. And I learned so much about how to run a live band from everyone that came through there, from Naomi and Jonathan, of course. So, you know, how they're arranged and what gets the dance floor hopping, and, you know, what makes them walk off the floor, and how long to have a song and things like that. So I was literally taking notes. But it was Gordon who has more of a, you know, he has a set list, but it was Gordon who has more of a jam style type set that I really connected with. And so I just kind of just took it from there. And I kind of reshaped my band and structured potential songs and all of that. So, but that was my favorite.
For our listeners who might not know, Beantown is a camp, and it's one of the longest running swing dance camps in the United States and in the modern 1980s plus era. And they have, as you can tell, they have a very supportive team there. Tony and Orly, who run it, are the kind of people who are like, no, you're singing tonight.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you're singing. So they're like, you know, they're fiercely supportive. Sure. And they have, you know, they bring in incredible bands. You know, you'll go to Beantown and see Jonathan Stout and Gordon Webster with Taryn and Naomi and her Handsome Devils. And like, you'll just see so many great, incredible bands in like a small room. You know, so it's, you feel like you're having an intimate dance with these bands that you usually only get to dance with in like a giant ballroom.
The thing about Beantown Camp is it's not a competition focused camp, and because you have more time, and there's more time for social stuff, you know, that you get to really get close to the people that you meet and hang out with. And that's really folded in. For example, we all eat dinner. We eat all of our meals together. So everyone has to stop whatever they're doing. The schedule is built that way. And you're all meeting in one place for all of your meals. It's, yeah, it feels more like family, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's where Chisomo and I got to hang out for an entire week. And we got to meet Darlene Gist, one of the great Malibu Parks and Norma Miller dancers. And we got to hang out with her for a week. And like, everyone was,
yeah. That's how I got to, I had been at events where I got to meet Norma, but it wasn't until Beantown that that Norma was forever one of the great loves of my life. So at Beantown Bounce, I heard that she was looking for me after I sang Honeysuckle Rose. And so after that, she called me either Taryn or Honeysuckle Rose, you know.
Man, when you get a nickname from Norma, you should keep that.
So, and she literally would push me in the forefront and say, you know, you tell me who I needed to talk to, or give me advice on different rhythms or syncopations to kind of sing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I have saved her voice recordings, because she gave me two songs that she wanted me to sing. She said that they're for me. So one of them was called Black Woman, named after the poem written for her mother in her book. And so she sang it for me in my voice recorder.
Okay. I don't have a voice, but this is the song that I sing. It was a black woman who gave life to me. It was a black woman who said I'd be free to live my life full and with dignity. These are the things a black woman gave to me. It was a black woman who carried the seed across the vast ocean so I'd be born free. She said to me, love and honor me. And these are the things a black woman gave to me. She said, as you sow, so shall you reap. By the sweat of your brow, you'll earn your keep. And that black was a heavy load to bear. But God put no more on one than one is able to bear. It was a black woman who gave pride to me and taught me that black was beautiful to be. She said to me, love and honor me. And these are the things a black woman gave to me.
And I performed that for her as a surprise for another show. And I just sang it a cappella, and that was
oh man.
So yeah, she'll forever be one of the great loves of my life. And she was amazing. I'm glad that my boys got to know her and, you know, and got to serve her, because whoever was near, it was Joshua, Jonas, and Kyle. Whoever was near was in charge of getting her Coke or her ice cream, you know, and then she got to coach them when they performed and, you know, stuff like that.
That's so cool.
I was just thinking about her and Youngblood, right? I was thinking about Kyle and how she would refer to him as Youngblood a couple days ago. I was just like, ugh, missing her. And so how incredible. What an incredible story.
Ugh. I would really love to. I have to figure out the legalities and the logistics of how I can record it. You know, I'm not sure how, you know, who do I talk to about that? But I would love to, like, do a full orchestration of her song.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So it was Norma's poem put to Norma's, Norma sang the harmony. And so she like wrote the melody of it. Yeah.
And she said, it's for you. She said, you're it. She said, it was my turn. She said, I'm giving this to you. And the things that led from that. So, you know, I had, before Beantown, I had never, you know, gone farther north than DC. And so that kind of catapulted my career. So with exposure at Beantown. So I got called to Rhode Island, and I got called to New York. I got to perform in New York. Because, you know, as a jazz musician, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I didn't feel legit until I sang in New York City, you know. But I actually got to perform with Norma for her cabaret show. Yeah. Where I sang our love is here to stay. So I'm trying to do things in keeping with the theme of her show about swing and jazz music. And she says, no. Well, I did sing that one, but she also wanted me to sing Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You. Mm. And so I wasn't going to be with her. That was not good.
Fun story. I was the DJ at my sixth grade dance. In hindsight, I don't know how they allowed me to DJ. Maybe they were like, oh, great, we don't have to buy a DJ. They somehow trusted me, even though I was the ADD kid who gave them hell several years before. But I was like, I'll DJ the dance. And they were like, and they said, yes. I don't know why, but that happened. Or maybe it was either the sixth or seventh grade dance. But basically, that was right when I Will Always Love You was the song. And what happened is I brought all my cassette tapes. It was a cassette tape DJ dance. And so I'm sure if I went back and saw it as, you know, my older self, I would see myself like, fast forward, and then just to find each spot on the songs.
Right.
But all the other kids brought their cassettes.
Uh-huh.
And like, there were a few of them that I put in and pushed play, and then a teacher would really quickly walk over and eject it and pull it out. But we listened to I Will Always Love You, I think, 3 or 4 times that night.
Yeah. It's a powerful song.
It is incredible. It's a little too powerful for me these days. Like if I start listening to it, I'm like, I don't know if I can go there right now.
Yeah, this is a song that, you know, you don't touch as a vocalist. You don't, just unless you really, really know it. And like if I were to have sung it in my 20s at the Apollo Theater, I would have gotten booed off. And then I started taking voice lessons myself because that I'd gotten into the big band and I felt like I needed some like extra support, you know, as a gigging musician, taking voice lessons. And that was one of the first songs that I had to work on with my voice teacher. And I literally cried when I did something that I didn't know that I could do. And with that particular big band, The Usual Suspects, that was a favorite that they always called for me to sing. And every time I sing it, I am super humble that I was actually able to do it because, like I said, that is not an easy song, you know.
It is. It's vocally taxing. It definitely reflects the chops of the vocalist, which, as Norma said, you're it. You're it. So that's incredible that she had you sing that song for her show. She was really good at reminding us, like, we're not just people and dancers of the past. We
right.
exist now, you know?
Yeah.
And so I feel like in singing I Will Always Love You, that iconic song now, people might be like, genre-wise, does that make sense? But in my mind, because of Norma, it really does make sense to me.
I didn't think of it that way, but you are perfectly right. You know, and because she always loved to thread the past with present and the future, you know, mm-hmm. making sure that we all remembered where we came from, where this mm-hmm. dance came from, and never to forget, you know, that's why she loved On the Boys so much, you know.
You know, and that reminds me, you know, there were sometimes when people would say that they would, like, let's say they listened to a few different Norma interviews, they would say, oh, it seems like Norma contradicted herself, you know, sometimes, because like in one interview, if you ask her, you know, how did y'all feel about your Lindy Hop back then, she'd say like, well, we were the best of the best. And then if you looked at another interview, she would say like, we were crapping Hell's a Poppin', we need, you know, like we didn't learn how to dance until after, you know, like we were young and we just weren't refined. Like if you're not dancing better than us, then there's a problem like that. So like, you know, and one could look at that and be like, oh, she's just contradicting herself. But I think that she was always reacting to the moment about like, what needs to be heard now in the scene? Like how do I need to answer this question now to help like teach something new about the past, the present, and the future?
Yeah.
And
speaking of that, I think a perfect example would be Urban Ballroom. I'm also on staff for International Swing Dance Championships, which is run by Tina Morales and a few other people. And so that is Urban Ballroom. And it something clicked for me when I went there. I felt like, okay, people thought that Lindy Hop was dead, but it's not. It just evolved with the music, you know, and the times. And it was the most glorious thing I've ever seen. You know, and in two places, and you know, if you were to take International Lindy Hop Championships and International Swing Dance Championships, they are both places of to me, wonderment, because it's like, okay, this dance is the origin, but this is where it went. And it did not, people think it died. It didn't, you know, just like our music, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. Like y'all swing dancers out there, what it means for this dance to have lived from then until now and into the future.
Yeah.
On the one hand, it didn't die in the Lindy Hop world in Harlem because they kept dancing it for generations and generations and generations. So Mama Lou Parks, who was still holding her classes, teaching young people around Harlem how to do Lindy Hop and keeping her Harvest Moon Ball contest going, that was happening into the 80s. And that's where, you know, the modern scene as we know it kind of internationally kind of took the reins after that, or took it in a different direction. But so that's the dance living there. And then also Lindy Hop evolved into all these other dance forms.
All the different regions have a different dance. You know, you have your Chicago stepping, you have your, to name a few, you know, you have your Detroit ballroom, you have DFW swing out of Dallas, Fort Worth. And the funny thing is when I go to these events, I pick, you know, I'm asked to dance by different people. And I just say, okay, I'm a Lindy Hopper. And they're like, oh, you're good. Come on. And I can follow, you know, so, you know, if you mastered Lindy Hop, and it's just following on the same, you know, on the same rhythm, but with different feels, it's really cool. There's actually a guy named John Seegers who runs an event called Trap and Swing, you know? Yes. And so I've been seeing pictures. I've been, you know, been wanting to catch up and see what he's up to. But it's a beautiful thing. And he learned from his grandparents, you know, and who did his grandparents learn from, you know? And it's beautiful. It's absolutely wonderful. I advise anyone to learn urban ballroom, you know, and just follow the progression of this dance and the music.
Yeah, hey, and, I took
I was gonna say, and shout out to Tina, right? Because yes. The you mentioned ISDC and ILHC, both of which she runs. So I know people are aware of how much she does for the swing scene, but I think we can definitely
mention
it. She does a lot.
It should be worth mentioning that, you know, not only do I get to sing on stage, but I am so privileged to be behind the scenes for these major dance events and see how people work and how much they love that they love the people and the dance, you know, and I don't think anyone should ever take that for granted.
Yeah. And I did want to put kind of an asterisk note. I've been in different conversations or been listening to different conversations about inclusion in music, as well as, you know, because we've talked about inclusion in dance events, making sure to increase representation. We've talked a little bit about teachers, but the conversation about musicians and what that looks like. And every time I hear people, a misnomer is that there aren't any Black musicians. And every single time I hear that, I'm like, what about Taryn? Come on.
It's not even just a what about Taryn, because the wealth of talent that I'm around,
right,
that people don't know is astounding. And that's right. That is my plan. That is my wish, my hope, my prayer, is to bring all of these amazing BIPOC musicians out to the forefront. And that was part of one of my other favorite events in swing dance music, is bringing my jazz world where they, you know, my jazz musicians into a world with dancers. And a lot of them didn't know that this was going on. So they're walking, the feeling that they had that said people are actually listening to jazz music on purpose, you know, but not at some art gallery. They're participating and they love it. That you would have thought that we had just, you know, what is that underground scene where they discovered how many people were outside of the matrix? You know, they didn't know how many people lived outside. And this was like that for them. And so it is my hope. I'm working with my producer, Larry Wilson, who is a phenomenal drummer and just a fabulous musician, to bring more people of color into my work, you know. And like I said, swing, when I got into the Lindy Hop world, I had never been so welcomed. I mean, there was a dramatic difference from ballroom and salsa and swing dance. I mean, and Lindy Hop. And the people are always incredibly, incredibly welcoming. Michael Gamble and Josh Collazo have been, you know, have invited me to sing with them. I sang with Josh Collazo at Beantown 1 year with his band. And Michael Gamble, I've done, you know, a few events with him, and that was awesome. And so it's been wonderful to be included, where you have people who are paying attention now and saying, oh yeah, I remember, yeah, there's, you know, on purpose, remembering me on purpose, and I'm completely humbled by it. But I want to infuse my favorite scene with some incredible musicians that you didn't know were out there. You know, case in point, Larry Wilson. I had one of my favorite pianists who lives in Dallas now. His name is Brian Hogans. I work with Louis Hurovo now. I mean, I could throw out all these names that people might not know that will have you hopping on the dance floor. And that's, you know, that's another thing about me, is I only play the stuff that I would really want to dance to. And these guys swing their faces off. There's something about the rhythm that's instilled, and when they lock in, is the most magic place in the world. I get that example from the movie Soul, where they're in this place where these people are, what was it, in the zone, and they're not even on this planet. And I think every musician or anyone who does anything, you know, like an art form or whatever, they're like, yeah, I get that. I'm just not here anymore. I'm locked into this music. And these people have inspired me so much, you know, and taught me many, many, many things about how to sing as a swing singer, you know. And if one of them tells you, you know, man, she really swings, that is just the greatest compliment, you know, as a vocalist. To be in lockstep with these guys who, you know, first of all, have studied very, very hard and traveled all over the world to, you know, bring us this amazing music. And then, but then combine it when you get to see them around dancers. I had one bass player, his name's Craig Shaw, who would say when he played, he loved to watch the dancers' feet. So that's where he would get his inspiration. And that just made me really happy. But yeah, I can talk about that forever. Just the stuff that I get to see, you know, as a dancer, seeing the people on the floor, and then being a dancer up on the stage, just right in the middle of it, you know. Yeah. I just felt like I was, you know, wrapped in a blanket, you know, really cozy. Yeah.
You know, anytime that a swing dancer, like, works hard to become a musician, it always makes me really happy, because I know they're going to do music that's going to make me want to dance.
And
vice versa, when a musician becomes a dancer, you're like, there's this symbiotic, really. It's awesome. So
absolutely.
So I did want to, like, throw in there are a number of, like, Black and African-American musicians that are doing some incredible things, like, yeah, Brittany Caraway, somebody comes to mind. Charles Turner and his band is doing some incredible things, and there are many, many others. And so this question of, like, are there Black artists that are out there? The answer is yes. And so, and also, if you have questions, right, reach out to Taryn.
Yes. I'm here. I mean, you know, I don't even mind giving out my phone number. So yes, we are here, and I would love to see more of it, you know, more of us. And I don't mean that in a way that we should just be there just for the sake of being Black. You know, we work really hard. We work really hard, and we see the results. And we see the results for, you know, for example, when you feel it on the dance floor, you know, when the audience is feeling you, and that's not something that, you know, you can necessarily put on a paper and quantify, but the feeling from the stage to the dance floor is like, okay, I got some good results, you know.
Yeah. And when we think, the case for diversity is always that it makes things better, right? And so their voices, there are things that we're missing out on when other people are not included. And then, since this is a historically Black art form, like, there are some incredible insights that I think we're missing out on when we're, like, not including the people from which this came from, right? And so, like you said, not just, you don't want to include somebody just because they're Black. Like, right. All of us who identify as Black have been in that situation at least one time, right? Mm-hmm. Where you've been included because of the color of your skin. It doesn't feel that great. And so, but like you said, the musicians that you know are worthy and are amazing. And so, yeah.
Some possible action items for our listeners is, first off, you can find Tara Newborn at
Facebook and Instagram. I am pretty organic. I had a website one time, but wasn't very consistent with it. But I'm pretty approachable. So find me on Facebook either at Tara Newborn Music or just my own personal page, or Instagram at Sing Taryn Swing. Yeah.
Awesome. So step one, check that out and how awesome it is. Step two, if you're a promoter and you're like, man, I would love to like learn more about these musicians she's talking about, perhaps message her. And if she is feeling so inclined, she may be able to help you out. And then thirdly, Black Lindy Hopper's Fund has a resources page for musicians and instructors and other people of color in the scene that you can go and check out.
Yes. Yes, that's pretty cool.
All right. Do you want to move on to the next question, Tisomo? Shar?
Yes. Sorry, that was me fumbling about. So is there anything that you want the people, as we were talking to the people right now, the people to hold on to as different as we're thinking about starting up again?
I would love for people to hold on to the sense of family in a way that they look at the world around them and maybe look at someone who could potentially be their family that they didn't normally think of at first, So I'm trying to figure out a way to really put this. I want people to hold on to the sense of family, but reconsider who you might consider as family. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I've been thinking a lot about the concept of chosen family.
Yes.
And that, is that kind of what you were referring to?
Yeah. Yeah. What does your, reconsider maybe what your chosen family looks like and may be like. For example, picking people with different backgrounds and different opinions, because anytime we have a different opinion, even though we may think we're right, it still broadens our minds. It makes us smarter when we get along with people who don't have the same opinion as we do.
Yeah.
Or the same outlook on life. Cause that, I think that would be really boring. And it's an echo chamber.
Yeah. I, in this time, I've spent a lot of time alone. And I remember there was a night where I was like, my friends got on my nerves. And the reason why was because I have people who disagree with me, right? And yeah. I was thinking about how important it is, exactly what you said, to have people who will challenge your perspective and with whom you may never agree. And because it allows you to figure out how to interact with those types of people. I was reading something the other day about how, I believe it was Claude Steele's book, Whistling Vivaldi. At the end of it, he was talking about how, and this was written about 10 years ago, like 11, 12 years ago. He kind of predicted that we would be where we are because we are moving into more and more silos, more and more echo chambers. And so the more distant we are from people who disagree with us, right, the more divided we become. And that's kind of the reason why we are where we are in the world right now. So.
Right.
Yeah.
There are a couple of people that I listen to. Well, my first main one, and I'll talk about her every day, is Dr. Caroline Leaf. She's a neuroscientist, a cognitive behavioral neuroscientist. And she talks about, negative thinking and literally what it looks like under a microscope and building positive thoughts. And she's one of those people who says, integrate your life with someone who is not like you, so that your brain literally builds new neural pathways and makes you smarter. And then, in this frustrating time, which, by the way, to me, I feel like the media is a whole lot more frustrating, because in real life, I don't see from my perspective, I don't see a lot of the things, the extremes that are going on in the media, with certain exceptions. But there was someone, I read an article about, what happens in your brain when you tell someone when you give someone facts other than what they've grown up, for example, what they've grown up listening to, for example, you know, most people know that George Washington had wooden teeth, you know, like, yeah, it's George Washington. We all knew that story. But they said, what if we were to tell you that George Washington's dentures were made out of the teeth of slaves? And a lot of people would argue with you. And so he said that giving someone facts other than what they have believed is the same as if you physically assaulted them. To their brain, you have physically assaulted them. And so by the end of that article, he was like, you know, be willing to understand what somebody else is going through when you have to give them new information that goes against what they believe. And then also pay attention to yourself. You have to listen to get past that part where you're physically assaulted, if that makes sense. So it was also, you know, not just about how to give someone information, but also how to listen and digest, you know, if you're the receiver of that.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that makes sense. When you mentioned your answer, Atlanta had a really good family feel in a lot of ways among a lot of its dancers. And then like some of the other scenes I've been in, it hasn't been that much. And I think in the overall scene, there's like friend groups, but I think it's different than family groups. If I'm going into Beantown and I pick up my food and I go look for a place to sit, then I might have like some friends that I'm like, oh yeah, you know, I'll go sit with my friends and have lunch with them today. And then when you walk past the Norma table, uh-huh, and you see Norma Miller and you see people of all different generations around, and you see like the things that they talk about and the camaraderie. And when you see that same family and how they interact on the dance floor and with each other and stuff, you're like, oh, that's a family. That's not just some friends who sit next to each other at lunch sometimes. So that was the way I interpreted your answer was that, oh, okay. So like, first off, we as the swing scene might have a much more fulfilling experience in the swing scene if we stop thinking about friend groups and start thinking more about family groups.
Yes.
That we make with our friends. And then second of all, the difference between family and friends is how you interact with them and like how, you know, how intimate you are in like, you know, in a different way, you know, not like romantic intimacy, but like a, you know, like a family intimacy.
Yeah. There are things that I have with the pandemic when it happened, I realized that I took a lot of people for granted that I would, you know, see them at my usual times of the year. And that's one of my biggest regrets, because I'd be like, nah, next year I'm going to go interact with that person, you know, or I'm going to make an effort to hang out. And that's something that I kind of rolled over throughout the years where I kind of took for granted, oh, maybe next time. And even the last few years before the pandemic, I would make a concerted effort to go and speak to that person. A lot of people don't know that I'm actually really shy. I'm planning to be tested for ADHD, and with ADHD comes rejection sensitivity disorder. And so if I'm not like right in your face and I haven't seen you in a while, I don't know that you even like me or know me or whatever. And so I was speaking to, Irina's sister, what is her name?
Natalia Aristotle.
Yes, I was speaking to her and on Facebook Messenger. And I think, I don't know who started the conversation, but we both said, you know what, I've adored you from afar, but I've kind of not been sure how to approach you, you know, but I just wanted to know, I adore you, you know, and I think what you're doing is wonderful. And we said, it's like, yeah, I've been too shy to approach you. And so that brought, I mean, it's like when we first get together, after, you know, when all of this is over, there are going to be so many people who are going to have me in their faces. You know, I'm going to hug so many people that I adore and probably interact a little bit, because I get, you know, I work registration. So I get to literally see every person come through and really soak in these people who I felt like I took for granted, who didn't know I was taking them for granted, who may not have known that I was thinking about them or whatever. But, you know, and so that's what I mean by the sense of family, but, you know, making sure that you really connect with people, you know, it's, you know, cause everybody is just so beautiful and so wonderful that, you know, I kind of want to be a part of that. But again, I'm a little shy, you know, on stage is different because I feel like I have a barrier, you know, did musical theater, I can hide behind a script and, and all of that, but it's the interpersonal that I really desire. It makes the whole thing, it makes the music, it makes the dance a whole lot more fulfilling.
By the way, listeners, musical theater and non-musical theater is rife with people who are shy. And like some of the greatest actors I've ever known on stage were incredibly shy off stage. And that's how they because they're full of all this stuff that they need to express or want to express, and they finally get to do it on stage, is because there is a fascinating outlet on stage for shyness in a weird way.
As a person who's kind of never really made sense in whatever space they've been in, because I've learned how to kind of adapt and flow with different people, and I've been an observer of people for years. And a thing that you can kind of always guarantee is if somebody is being standoffish or whatever, it doesn't necessarily mean that they think that they're better than anybody else, because 8 out of 10 times that I've engaged with somebody who's a little bit standoffish, the interaction is really positive, you know, especially if you're not trying to just seek validation from them, but if you're genuinely wanting to connect with the person. And so I think we really need to watch what we assume about how other people present, right? And so, yeah. And then also to move with kindness and excitement, because all of us are thinking oh no, people are going to hate me. They're not going to like me. People are responding to me. And it's no, actually people are responding to their own lives.
Right.
And it is really Bobby and Taryn, you are both, you have an amazing stage presence and you're captivating. And I'm sure people see you as you're teaching, as you're singing, as you're performing. They're I want to know that person. And then they approach you and you're I don't necessarily want to be the center of attention when I am not holding a microphone.
And part of the draw of the swing, I have two things to say about that, but part of the draw of the swing scene for me is that I found my tribe because we're basically all nerds. Yeah. So that means that we're all the cool kids. So that's how I feel about that. But when I'm on staff, on staff for an event, I'm running registration. So I'm one of the first people that you might see and encounter. And so by the end of 4 hours, I've talked to 400 to 500 to 700 people.
Right.
And so my brain is I can't do any more things. That's also probably why I don't get to interact with so many people, because my job at these functions, my battery is depleted by, I've talked to enough people. There's one time at Beantown and I had done registration and there was maybe about 45 minutes before dinner. And I tried to find a corner so I could read my book, and Norma comes up the stairs, Taryn, I was looking for you, And I was okay. Hi, Norma. I was genuinely glad to see her, always, but I just kind of had to, and a lot of us feel that way. Performing on stage and being all of these things, it really drains a battery and executive functioning.
I wanted to highlight a thing that you'd said a while ago about when you present somebody with information that is counter what they know and that physical response. I thought that was such a brilliant point, and I just really wanted to say I love that point. I think it's really important for us to remember that, because when we get into these conversations where something just seems like a point of fact to you and you present it as such to somebody else and they aren't as receptive, we kind of need to take a step and remember for them, they just got kind of a physical punch to the face. So right. Yeah. Yeah. And so that, I think that engenders empathy and kindness and also reminds us that it is important that we have grace for one another as we traverse somewhat challenging territory.
That's true.
Yeah.
So when's there going to be an album of Taryn Newborn?
Well, okay. So the only thing stopping me from an album is just money. It's just, that's all.
Money. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, with the pandemic, I didn't make so much of it, you know, but, you know, I'm not discouraged because there's always ways to do things and it'll happen in time. But I've been thinking about this album for so long, you know, mixture of big band charts, you know, and I plan to call it Taryn Newborn and the Really Big Deal. That's the band. And, you know, just different concepts of swing and blues and ballads and all of that stuff. So I've got a lot on my mind.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Is there any way that our listeners can maybe help throw some cash at you to help this happen?
Yes, you can find me on, and I will send you the links and whatnot. Let's see, PayPal is TarynsDream@gmail.com. Venmo is @Taryn-Newborn. Cash App is @SingTaryn Swing. So, or, you know, you can get through Facebook nowadays. There's a button for that. Or just ask me. Find me on Facebook. Friend me on Facebook. And, yeah, we'll figure things out. And that would be lovely. Or if anyone wants to take voice lessons, you know, I can be reached through that way. One of the great things about the pandemic, it expanded my student base to not just my local area, but I've got students in D.C., in Alabama, in California, as well as Georgia, and I would love to, you know, expand that. So
that's amazing. You listeners, you can help make this amazing thing happen, and you can also do so while learning how to swing. And that was unintended. By learning how to sing and swing at the same time, if you so desire.
Yeah, absolutely. And also performance coaching. I have, you know, students who are auditioning or just wanting to get out of the shell. And my students are ages 6 to age 70 so far. So anyone of any age, I'd love to, you know, to just interact with more people.
Thanks so much for listening, everyone. You can donate to Taryn Newborn's album project by going into our notes and looking at any of those four ways to donate. Cash App, Venmo, PayPal, Zelle, it's all there. By the way, PayPal and Zelle are TarynsDream@gmail.com. That's TarynsDream@gmail.com. We also have the Cash App and the Venmo in the notes.